The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Okay, and welcome back. Here we are, right on time, Thursday night. We're going to talk this first hour with Dr. Henry L. Nyman, who is our virologist specialist, a brilliant man. But we're going to talk about something different tonight. Henry has a new field he's going to explore, and it does look like it's going to be something that I think all of us are going to come into contact with one way or another very soon. It has to do with genetics and DNA and all kinds of things. It's a fascinating field. Henry, welcome back.
Oh, it's good to be back, Jeff. And like you said, I think we're going to shift gears a little bit tonight and talk about this personal DNA testing and you know what its potential is and what actually is there.
Personal DNA testing. Think about that, ladies and gentlemen. I guess that means you can send off a swab and get your DNA back and look at it and whatever.
You don't have to do a swab. All you got to do is spit in a tube.
Wow. So it's, what if my aim is bad?
Well, they give you a funnel.
No excuses.
You don't have to hit it the first time. You know, you get a little bit on your hand, but yeah, you just have to keep spitting until you get like 7/10 of an ml in there.
All right. I got it. ML means that big talk for a milliliter. I got it.
Right. It's got a little wavy line, so you just have to look at the liquid. You can't count the bubbles, so there are a lot of bubbles on the top. They don't count. You got to get the liquid up to the line, and once you do that, you just kind of put in the stabilization fluid by closing the lid, mm-hmm. you know, and shake it up, put it in a bag, put it in the box, and drop it in the mailbox.
And what happens when we get the results? What do these do for us? What are they going to tell us? That's what we want to get into.
Right. So, you know, I thought we'd do this, you know, just to back up a little bit. Things have kind of slowed down on the avian influenza front. There's some activity, H7N9, still in China, particularly in northern China, and there's some indications of cases that are associated with dead poultry. So it looks like the high-path version may be circulating up there. But it's you know, it's winding down quite a bit, and there haven't been any new sequences, so can't really tell exactly what's going on. And the H7N9 in the U.S. Is also kind of fading now, and Zika really hasn't gotten going yet in the U.S. as far as local cases are concerned. So, mm-hmm. you know, I thought that it would be a good idea to kind of go over this this DNA testing. I kind of got interested, it's probably been about 6 weeks ago or so, or maybe it's 2 months ago by now. And I was a little bit interested in looking at some of the tumor markers, predispositioning tumor markers, where you would have you know, a high level of cancer in a given family, uh-huh. and you'd look at markers to see if indeed there were certain markers that showed up with individuals that did get cancers versus the other individuals.
And, are these tendencies to get, or are these actual markers that would suggest it is established in your body?
Okay, this is, these are, I mean, when you spit in the tube, basically they're going to spit out the white blood cells. So they're essentially taking the DNA out of the white blood cells. And so they're essentially looking at what the DNA that you inherit or what you're born with.
Right.
And so they can, you know, it's a little bit different than the viruses. This is, you know, you got 23 pairs of chromosomes. You get one from your mother, one from your father. And so for each position, there's really, you know, two different sequences. And you really are looking at that to see what they call, they report them out as SNPs. They're called, SNP stands for single nucleotide polymorphism. So they're a given position in the DNA. It's a polymorphism, as in, you know, there are at least two different versions of it there. You know, just as a refresher, your DNA's only got four letters. It's ATGC. And if there are polymorphism at that position, that means that the two sequences you have, one from your mother, one from your father, at that position are vary, and frequently that you'll be heterozygous there. You'll have one letter from your mother and another letter from your father. So you have two different letters at that one position. And these positions that vary, they kind of get tabulated. There's a very large database of these polymorphisms. Actually, you can go to the same place that I go to get viral sequences at GeneBank, and they have a SNP database. So they've got a database, got all these SNPs. These are all from humans. They're all, you know, they've got a name, and then the name kind of tells you what the sequence is, and it tells you what chromosome it's on and what position on that chromosome. And so if you do this test, if you go and you spit in the tube and they extract your DNA, and you know, the cost has gone down pretty dramatically. A test, you know, the more common, popular test that I'm going to talk about tonight is 23andMe and Ancestry. And the Ancestry is like $99. So you spit in the tube, you pay $99, send it in, and they send you an email saying, you know, go to the site and go to your account, and you can browse your raw data, so you can actually search your data for a given SNP or a given disease. And or you can actually download your data, so you can download your whole file. It's a zip file. You unzip it, and there's about take a guess how many polymorphisms you think you get for $100?
Maybe many hundreds.
about 500,000.
So, that's all, huh?
So,
wait a minute now. This is almost a total genetic readout in your body.
Well, it isn't quite as total as you might think. There's, you've got...
That's enough to get you in trouble.
Literally millions base pairs, but uh-huh, they do cover uh-huh a lot, and that's what I was going to go through tonight a little bit on what they actually do cover, and they cover a lot more than most people realize. You probably have seen the ads. The ancestry is also popular. And that also is $99. 23andMe actually has two versions. They've got the ancestry version, and then they have the ancestry plus health version. That's $200. So those are the two different types of tests that you can order. Although, I don't know this for sure. I'll know this probably in a month or so. But I'm almost positive that the raw DNA that you get is the same regardless if you do the $99 or the $199. What you get for the extra $100 is really reports. And the initial advertisement is that you can get reports on various traits to see if you're a carrier. And these are kind of the, they used to be called inborn errors of metabolism. They basically are recessive defects, so that you really need two bad copies to have the severe effect from the disease. If you only have, one bad and one good, the good copies good enough to prevent symptoms. So you, but without a test, you really don't know whether you're a carrier. And so it's useful to know.
A carrier of what?
If you're a carrier, because if somebody, if you basically produce a child with somebody who's also a carrier of that same gene.
Carrier of what, Henry? Carrier of what? Okay, disease? Defective?
A DNA mutation that would essentially inactivate that particular protein. That's
what, might
made
give
by
you
that gene.
Give the baby two heads? That kind of a defect?
It would be, they're usually inborn errors of metabolism. So there's something that they have to metabolize, that they eat, et cetera, and they can't really metabolize it because the enzyme that's required to do the metabolizing, you can do it if you got one good copy of the enzyme. If you have two bad copies of the enzyme, then you can't really metabolize that particular product, and it can build up. Tay-Sachs disease is one example. I'm not that familiar with the different types of diseases, but typically what would happen is if you had one bad copy and you were just a carrier, and your partner had one bad copy of the same gene, then it would basically be a quarter of the babies would not be carriers at all. They would each get a good gene from each parent, and then half of them would be carriers. They get one good gene and one bad gene. And then another quarter would actually have the disease. They would have two bad genes. And if they had two bad genes, generally, whatever they normally would be able to do, they can't do, and it builds up and usually leads to death, and usually leads to death at a very young age, in the area of months or so. And so, that's a bad combination to have. I believe states require testing on that, especially if you're in a population that might be predisposed to that, they'll let you know if you basically both have the same bad gene. They're relatively rare, and so it'd be even rarer that two people would both have the same gene. I mean, that's one of the reasons first cousins can't get married, is the likelihood of them pairing up with, you have a certain number of bad genes that you are a carrier for, and if there's not a lot of diversity, then the chances of two parents having that same bad gene increases. And so that's one of the reasons for avoiding those types of marriages and pregnancies. But in any event, that's what you get for the health version. Is they look at I think it's 41 different types of diseases that fall into those categories, and you know, they will tell you if you are a carrier, and then they'll explain that particular disease and you know what would happen if there was a baby
Two questions. The second one's a big one. The first one is, what happens if the funnel spits back at you? Number two,
as in you get hit with your own spit.
Yes. Life can be funny, Henry. All right. Now the second one is, what if somebody got hold of your results, came into your home, took them off your computer, took them out of your desk, whatever. Is there anything that somebody could do with that data to in any way compromise, harm, or infringe upon your rights? We all know we have very little privacy anymore, and now it looks like this is a database that will end all mysteries about each individual. So what's the downside?
I mean, there are laws against... when these tests first started coming out, there was concern not that somebody was really going to do harm to you in the sense that they were going to, you know, actually do anything with your data that would somehow result in some physical harm to you. But there was concern that insurance companies would use the data and basically see, well, if you got, you know, predisposed to get X, Y, or Z, you know, they wouldn't insure that type of disease, or they'd charge a higher premium for that, or they would, you know, use your genetic information to determine what your risk was, and then charge your premium based upon that risk. And to avoid that, there is confidentiality, and there is, you know, you get in an area that's not my specialty, but, you know, there are laws against releasing that data, or insurance companies getting a hold of that data and using it. So
good luck.
So that's probably the biggest risk for actually having that data. You have to fish it out. It's not that hard to fish out. And I'll go through that when I give a little bit of detail on what's in the databases.
Let me ask you another hypothetical question. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I don't want to get this too far down the road. If somebody got your sequences and all the results, is there anything that a closet scientist could concoct and somehow give you in a drink or a food or whatever that could cause some kind of a genetic argument in your body, a crisis, something? Is there any way to use this and in a negative way toward influencing somebody physiologically?
Not really. I mean, you could... You might see if somebody's got sickle cell disease or something like that.
Would those be transmissible? Sickle cell anemia or some other kind of genetic predisposition to a disease?
All you're getting is a readout.
These aren't infectious organisms.
The changes that cause sickle cell disease are published, so you wouldn't need somebody's DNA to find out, you know, what kind of change you would have to make in carrying in hemoglobin and cause a sickle cell crisis type of a thing. I mean, the actual changes in genes are published in public, and you can find that out. That wouldn't, you know, getting that from an individual wouldn't really help very much. You know, I think the main issue would be, as I said, you know, that you could find out what somebody was potentially susceptible to on a certain type of disease. And again, there are laws against, even if an insurance company did, you know, get your DNA, or they got a doctor's report, you know, are not supposed to use that.
Well, I'm saying that they could potentially drop you. They could drop you or raise your premium or drop you.
Right. And you know, there are laws against doing that. That's not how insurance companies are supposed to operate. They're not supposed to basically get your genetic information and then use that to make, you know, predictions on what your health is going to be, and then, you know, charge you more, drop you or whatever. You know, so that would, those would be illegal acts, as far as I know. Again, it's a little bit out of my area, but those are some of the initial concerns, and there has been legislation to address those concerns, and there are privacy rules as far as, if you had your raw DNA and gave it to your doctor, you know, that would be a confidential piece of medical information. It's not something that they would, you know, make readily available for somebody else to copy or some insurance company to get an act on. Like I said, I don't think they can act upon it. So there's not much in that way, you know, in that vein, as far as what's going to happen with your DNA. What's of interest, though, is exactly, like I said, there's like a half a million of these SNPs that are in your raw data file, and those, you know, address many, many different issues. And I was going to kind of go through that a little bit with a couple examples of what you can get out of that, and what implications some of data would have, and what kind of additional follow-ups that would have.
Okay, and, all right, by all means. We have a break coming up here pretty soon. Here, we're rolling into it, so kind of wrap it up for this half hour, and we'll come back and elaborate on some of these things. So just yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, just to kind of wrap up the first segment, well, I mean, one of the reasons this is kind of topical, other than the fact that the other things I normally talk about are not as topical today, is that 23andMe did just get FDA approval for 10 of their tests. And so the FDA, you know, to do that, they basically have submit data showing that they basically have a low level of false negatives and a low level of false positives. And with the test, they go and they give an explanation, and they do it in fairly simple terms so that people can understand, you know, what the test means, you know, what the test results means. And that just got released on the 6th of this month, so it's just a couple of weeks ago. And I was going to go through, you know, a couple of the ones that were included. Actually, that's what they got approval for. And just a couple of days ago, actually, they released the first 5 reports out of the 10 they got approved. And included in the 5 that were just released were both Parkinson's disease and late onset Alzheimer's disease. And I was going to talk a little bit about the Alzheimer's disease and what they report on and what else is out there. And then I was going to talk about the cancer markers and the
starting
with the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes.
We'll do that in just a couple of minutes as we explore a new field for us, personal DNA. Back in a minute. back. Personal DNA testing. No privacy. Nowhere to hide. As stories out, we are as transparent as a piece of glass. Wow. Go ahead, Henry. Let's get into this.
Okay. So, like I said, I got into it a couple of months ago or so, and I was interested in some of the genes that predispose to cancer, and the two most famous genes in that area are BRCA1 and BRCA2. Uh-huh. BRCA stands for breast cancer, BR is breast, and CA is cancer. So it's breast cancer 1 and breast cancer 2, and they're fairly well known because of some studies that were done. I think they were in the mid 90s or so on these genes that were initially identified in Ashkenazi Jew populations, and uh-huh. and these are tend to be fairly homogeneous populations. It was known that they. There were families that had high frequencies of both breast and ovarian cancer, and then samples were collected from such types of cluster families to identify what genes were actually associated with that high frequency of cancer in these families, and. They ended up identifying two genes called BRCA1 and BRCA2, and they're both somewhat similar. And this is kind of a theme that gets repeated. These two genes normally function to correct errors that happen when cells divide, and actually this is, this is kind of my area, it's actually in recombination, and so there's recombination that does go on in human chromosomes where you kind of jump from one chromosome to the other, and sometimes there's mistakes made when that happens, and these two proteins are responsible for identifying those mistakes and cleaning them up and getting rid of them. And so, they form an important function to maintain the fidelity of the copying process. And if you have one bad gene, then that type of proofreading and cleaning up is not that efficient. And one of the possibilities, the distinct possibilities, if you have one good gene and one bad gene, over in your lifetime, you can end up getting rid of the good gene and end up with two bad gene copies. And that will generally lead to cancer because when you now have kind of converted and you have now two bad genes in the cell, they won't clean up these mistakes. And these mistakes, these mutations will accumulate and they'll eventually hit other genes that are controlling the cell's growth, and that growth will get out of control. And in these two populations in particular, in this population in particular, two of the results are either breast or ovarian cancer. And the frequencies are pretty dramatic, that in general population, the frequency of ovarian cancer is around 1 to 2%. And in populations that have one of these three founder mutations, it jumps up to around 40%. So, it's like a over 20-fold increase in the frequency of ovarian cancer. And the same thing happens, but not quite as dramatic in breast cancer because that's got a higher frequency in the general population. It's around 12%, and then that jumps up to 60-70% if you've got one of these three mutations. And the mutations that were identified, there were two that were identified in BRCA1 and one that was identified in BRCA2. They're all three of them were friendships. And, you know, just to back up over, you know, to go through a little bit on basic genetics is you got your DNA. Like I said, there's only four letters, and they're just kind of a long string of all of these letters. And to go from the DNA in the middle of this, you know, the inherited copies of the cell to the actual enzymes or proteins that are made, there's a reading frame that it reads three of these letters at a time, and then it kind of reads three, and that codes for one amino acid, and the next three code for the next, and the next, and you know, if you're in the right reading frame, you'll end up getting the right protein made. But if you get a letter, one or two letters inserted or deleted, that will cause you to shift the reading frame. And then once you shift the reading frame, the code changes. So instead of putting the right amino acid that's encoded by your normal DNA, you move the reading frame, and all of a sudden you start putting in the wrong amino acid. And then, just as a quick review, there's 64 different codons. You know, that's just basically the term, because there's four letters and it's three at a time. So it's right. Just it's just four cubed, get 64.
Right. I have another question when we get to a break. Another question when we get to a break. Go ahead.
Okay, and three of those 64 are stop codons. So when you get that, the protein stops. And that's the end of it. You know, that's the last codon of that protein. And so if you change reading frames, you typically will start putting in the wrong amino acid. And then, you know, on average, one out of 20 codons or so is a stop codon. So you'll go about 20 positions or so, give or take, and you'll get a stop codon. So you'll get a premature termination. And, you know, just as an example, that's what one of these, the first of the two frame shifts in BRCA1 are. It basically happens where two nucleotides get deleted. They're the ones that were encode the 23rd amino acid in the protein. And that it actually would terminate 17 positions later. And this protein is normally over, I think it's over 1,600 amino acids, and when you have this frame shift, you end up with a protein that's only 40 amino acids, and starting with position 23, it starts putting in the wrong amino acids. So you have a little tiny protein instead of a big, long protein, and even of the tiny protein, only the first 23 positions or 22 positions are actually correct. And so these frame shifts are dramatic mutations. They pretty much kill off the protein. The protein can't function. And these genes products don't usually work, you know, alone. They kind of form a complex with other products. And then as a complex, they basically perform their function. And so if one of them is shortened and has a wrong sequence, then that not only will affect that gene, but it will affect the other normal genes that normally complex with it. And it just won't get the job done correctly. So these frame shifts are pretty dramatic. The three mutations that were identified in BRCA1 and BRCA2, actually all three were frame shifts. And these were called founder mutations because these are mutations that happened you know, centuries ago, and they just were propagated within the population. That generally, for you to kind of get to the level where you're developing the cancers, they're frequently early, but they're not too early to prevent childbearing. I mean, women usually start to develop their tumors when they're in their 30s or 40s, and so that's early for cancer, but not early for reproduction. And so so the genes get carried through the population. They get cancer after they've pass the gene on to the next generation. And so these mutations that were present, you know, centuries ago get propagated through the population. And especially if it's a close-knit population, it tends to stay in that group. And the group is fairly easily distinguished from others outside. And so you can see that the group has a high frequency of breast and ovarian cancer. And then you notice that the women that do get the breast and ovarian cancer, actually it causes breast cancer in men also. But, you know, it's a much higher frequency in women. They tend to have one of these three mutations. And so the population studies were pretty straightforward, and a lot of times that people talk about BRCA1 and BRCA2, they're really talking about these three mutations, and they're frequently talking about the Ashkenazi 2 population.
Uh-huh.
But as it turns out, these are critical genes, and they're not limited to that population, but frequently in other populations, they affect those two genes, one or the other of those two genes, but they don't happen at those three precise positions that gave rise to those frame shifts. And so that kind of gives you an example where you can see different types of changes, different SNPs that associate with a given group. And so a lot of the data that's reported, you know, for ancestry doesn't really even talk about medical applications for the data. They just talk about, you know, determining what your ancestry is and what, you know, what part of the world you're from or what kind of group within that geographical area or, you know, history. But as it turns out, most of the markers that are being used to determine these genetic differences between groups are actually markers that are also involved with the diseases. And so they kind of serve a dual function. In the case of the BRCA1 and BRCA2, they kind of say that those particular proteins are the frame shifts make it give rise to the breast and the ovarian cancer. So they're markers of those two types of cancers. And actually, they're markers for additional cancers at a lower frequency. They also cause pancreatic and prostate cancers.
My turn? Okay.
Yeah.
These markers, are they causal factors in the diseases, or are they just a sign that says, hey, there's a risk for breast cancer here or some other cancer? What is it?
No, they are the causes. As I mentioned in the introduction. For BRCA1 and BRCA2, the function of those two proteins is to clean up errors that happen during recombination. And so if they are not functioning, or if other proteins that associate with them and these complexes aren't functioning, then these mutations, these mistakes that happen don't get corrected. And then you start having many mistakes in a given cell. And eventually those mistakes end up affecting proteins that tell the cell to stop growing or to kind of behave properly, and those controls get lost. And then the person develops cancer.
Follow-up question. Now, is there any way that we know and have within our realm of scientific possibility now to do a complete genetic change in somebody to remove these trigger genes which cause diseases? You can't go cell by cell. It would have to be a universal change in that gene. Is there any idea how that could be done?
Well, that's hard. I mean, if there's some defective genes, I mean, there's gene replacement therapy where you can basically take cells that have a defect and basically correct that defect. And then
In one cell.
So, you know, if it's something that you can get rid of the cells through radiation and then repopulate with the cells that you did the gene therapy, and that's how you do those types of replacements. And so you kill off all the existing cells and then you replace it.
Yeah, but these genes are in virtually every cell of the body.
Right, but what I'm saying is if it's in a cell that you can kill off and replace, like in white blood cells type things. You can do those types of gene replacements.
That would help. That would help mitigate and minimize some of the risk.
So there's some things that if you're born with, you can correct that type of thing. With something, you know, like this, you know, these BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes, that wouldn't be a feasible fix. That essentially what you have is
as you said
they're in every cell, and so you're born with it, and then you've got every cell in your body actually has
Henry, you've got to build a device that would look like, for all practical purposes, like an MRI device, a machine. They'd roll you in there, and somehow they could tweak every gene in the body of the person in that machine and clean up their disease-causing genes, their defective genes. So that's where we have to go. That's where we need to do.
Well, you'd probably do that with a virus, and you'd basically have that.
Explain that, because that goes back to our last visit. This is very interesting. They're using viruses to transmit synthetic, let's say, corrected genes into the cells of the human body. And if the viral load gets to be so massive, they're going to reach a lot of cells with this correction synthetic gene material. That would be very interesting. Very interesting.
Right. And there's things called CRISPR, which basically do editing, and you can do these types of changes. And so, I mean, this is getting a little bit further afield and not my area.
No, I'm going to put one in a van, and we're going to go around and do neighborhood calls, and you and I are going to become famous.
Right. So anyway, right now, what you can do is you can find out what some of these issues are, and
so they need to make a virus that will bring the synthetic corrected gene into a body. Let's say you find a gene that says that you're going to get breast cancer at 40, 45 years old. They give you viruses that will carry the synthetic genetic material into this every cell they hit. And when you get really sick, it hits a lot of cells. These viral loads can be enormous.
The biggest problem with cancer is that, the difficulty is that it's once it's there and it's in all the cells, you know, if it's in all the breast cells, for instance, then its job is to kind of clean up these errors. And it's not that easy to get that into.
I understand.
You know, every breast cell to do that. And so the only ones that, you know, cause the cancer are the ones that you got the right combination of errors that don't get corrected. Then all of a sudden that cell starts to grow and take off and then causes the problem. So it's with cancer, it's difficult because you basically the cancers really start from a single cell, and so you just have one cell that has this error in copying, and then it leaves it vulnerable to make more copies of the one mistake. And like I say, these ones that do the correction, more errors start accumulating, and then pretty soon the cell is growing out of control. And then you have your other ways of treating it with surgery or chemotherapy or radiation, and some you know, some directed you know, modalities that are based upon what genes you actually do have. And I mean, the BRCA1 and BRCA2, there's some treatments that are more effective for that type of disease.
Mm-hmm.
So, let me just run through very quickly because it looks like we're running out of time here. So the point I wanted to make was, you know, I was kind of interested in the BRCA1 and the BRCA2. I couldn't really tell from the literature for 23andMe whether they actually covered that. You know, I knew that they had the carrier status, but once I finally did get my results back and went to the website, they do allow you to search your DNA. So I actually just put BRCA1 into the search box, and it came up with, I think it was 608 SNPs for the BRCA1 gene, and there were over 600 SNPs for the BRCA2 gene. And so they, you know, they clearly had chosen, you know, a large number of SNPs in both of those genes. And then I actually got the raw data from a DNA, an ancestry raw data. And because 23andMe, I could, I mean, if you do the search, it gives you each of the SNPs, and each of the SNPs, it tells you what chromosome they're on. And then it gives you what position on the chromosome. And so you can kind of, in the case of this, you have to keep hitting, show more, because it's like, I think, 7 pages worth of SNPs. But once you go through the seventh page, you can see what position it ends at. And then by noting the first position going to the last position, you can go to the raw DNA data, which organizes the data by chromosome and then by position on that chromosome. And so you can just kind of page down to the right chromosome and then go through the right position and then go down to the from the first to the last position. And I did that with the ancestry data and found out that they actually had 2,000 SNPs for BRCA1, and they had almost 3,000 SNPs for BRCA2. And so it was clear that ancestry, even though they didn't talk about any health applications, so they were just talking about looking at you know, relationships between various groups, we're in fact using these same regions to do that type of analysis. And so they were using SNPs for these two popular genes. And then it turns out that there are whole panels of genes that are associated with different types of diseases. And one of the largest panels I saw was actually had 80 different genes with predisposition for cancers. And I went through those 80 genes with 23andMe to see if they were covered. And in fact, 79 out of the 80 were covered. And the only one that wasn't covered was one that they had discontinued. They had covered it in the past. And so it was clear that these different panels of genes that are relatively expensive to be done in a clinical lab, you could actually go ahead and get that type of data by looking at these databases and the raw data, and to get the SNPs with 23andMe, they actually give you the sequence on each of the two arms of the chromosome. And it gives you the number of the SNP, and you can search that in databases like GeneBank, and right, then they'll frequently have clinical data on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the same thing happened with when
okay,
the reports
we gotta wrap it up, Henry. Sorry.
Right. And so the same thing happened with Alzheimer's disease, they have a series of markers there, whether you're susceptible to late onset. And just to kind of wrap it up, those reports kind of give you the main marker and whether you're susceptible, but it turns out there's a whole bunch of additional related markers that are present or not that may affect those values. And so the point is that these personal kits, although they're advertised for a limited number of applications, really are designed for the future, where they're going to be using them to look at quite a few different types of illnesses. And with the raw DNA, you can actually look at those today and develop profiles for individuals.
Very nice. Very nice. Very nice. All right. Good report. Thank you, Henry. We'll watch this and see where it goes. Something new to spend your intellect on. And thanks for the update. We understand it. Good. This whole thing of viruses delivering synthetic DNA is a huge topic. We should spend more time on that if we can, too, next time, perhaps. All right?
Okay. Very good.
Okay. Thank you, Henry.
Okay.
Yeah. Take care. All right. Dr. Henry Nyman, and we will be right back with Hour 2.